You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is August 8th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Alex Quatros is going to be discussing his new book, Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. The Olympics ongoing in Brazil, the games seem to have gotten off to an okay start after all of the debacles leading up to the beginning of the games. And the Donald Trump debacle continues, though it seems like over the weekend he managed to not call anybody retarded, insult any veterans. And that earned the support of Jeb Bush's son. Wow. We're officially at the point now where I really feel bad for Jeb Bush, and I never thought that was possible. Still not empathy, more like pity, but it's something.
That's a temporary feeling.
Oh, yeah, it's not. It's a feeling that would fuel more jokes about his mother molesting him, so it's not really going to change any of my behavior. The African National Congress was delivered a significant blow in local elections in South Africa as a result of the dissatisfaction around the leadership of President Jacob Zuma. And could this mean in 2018 we're talking about a no longer African National Congress governed post-apartheid South Africa? Get to that. And we have a lot of sounds. Alex Jones is upset. I know that that's not distinct, but he's upset specifically about Malia Obama twerking at Lollapalooza. Now, he doesn't exactly know what twerking is, and you just might be surprised about his justification for being upset about said imaginary twerking. And Donald Trump, someone forced him his Adderall, and he has glumly endorsed Paul Ryan, John McCain, and Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire. Dude. She's running like a wicked lame race, and she's going to lose. John McCain, apropos of nothing, is still endorsing Donald Trump, even though after Donald Trump called him a loser for getting captured by the North Vietnamese, which is still one of my favorite things that Donald Trump has ever done. I'm going to miss him. Just going to say that. This is going to be over in a couple of months. He's going to start a media empire that will undercut Alex Jones and Fox News. And
be good content for us.
Yeah, so I look forward to further fruitful collaborations with Donald Trump in the future. We got a new Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow. New reviews on iTunes and Stitcher. Just overwhelmed and incredibly appreciative about all the feedback we're getting. Tomorrow, there's some beef in the studio about Charles Barkley. So you'll find out about that tomorrow by subscribing to Two Dope Boys. That's number two. Dope Boys, and a podcast on iTunes, Two Dope Boys Pod, that's spelled out, .com, and Two Dope Boys and a podcast on Stitcher. How was everybody's weekend? Matt?
Mine was good. I made a...
wearing a tank top.
Yeah, well, sun's out, guns out. I was home in... I was home for a wedding, second time in 2 months that I've been back for a wedding.
It's an interesting little hustle you got going on there.
If I'm lying about it, I did make a 25-minute wedding video that all the aunts and uncles seemed
to like.
That
would be exactly the way you would lie.
To do a lot of work.
But weird work that you might enjoy under the influence of a certain, you know what I mean? Just like you, I could see you getting into like, hey, wedding videos. It's a fascinating art form.
You're not quite onto my scams yet, Michael.
Ooh. Okay. I believe that. Kelly, what's up with you?
I had a good weekend. I met up with a friend who lives in Harlem and hasn't been to Williamsburg in, I don't know, probably 10 years.
Wow. And sounds like a good call.
Right, but I had to do something right by Bedford Avenue, and she met me there, and she was just, it boggled the mind. She was like, what is happening?
Oh, because of the sea change.
Oh, my gosh. There's an Apple store. I live kind of close to there, but I don't really go there. There's an Apple store, a Whole Foods, and basically, for anyone who doesn't know New York, it's just completely changed in a matter of a couple of years.
Yeah, no, it's the pace of gentrification is insane. We're going to be right back with Alex Quatros on The Majority Report. Yes, I am. Wow. Give me the remedy, the fire fi go burn. I said the tables turn. Give me the remedy, the fire fi go blaze. Burn Babylon, dirty way. Eternal fire, dirty Babylon, you will go get bruised. And you want them fire. I said they're just here when you're going lose. We are want them. Ooh, yeah. I'm back up on one. Me, I beg you, move, yeah. I beg you, back up on one. Me said that movement. Life. Marcus if we organize and centralize. Rastafi own banks and enterprise. So me nah stop chanting my soul enter Zion. Princes of fire, Babylon me tell ya your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me or your transpire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire, dirty Babylon you are gonna get bruised. Me a want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going lose.
Welcome back to The Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Alex Quatros. He is the author of Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. He's a freelance journalist who has just spent 6 years in São Paulo. He's now based in New York City. Alex, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well.
It's great to be speaking with you. So, you know, Brazil is obviously a very sort of dynamic, fascinating place. After several years of very positive global press coverage, you had a president who, and Lula, who left office several years ago with one of the highest approval ratings in the world, and, you know, an actual approval rating, not like a Gaddafi approval rating. He really was an incredibly popular president. Then you had Dilma take over from him, and she's in many respects a very impressive figure. You know, exploding growth, but also delivery on social justice. They were part of the BRIC countries, which was the sort of notion of kind of reorienting global power. So in the last couple of years, that's completely gone off of the rails. And what your book is doing, I think, and one of the things that's fascinating about it, is getting to the sort of deeper structural history of why that launch sort of didn't fully happen and where we go from here. But can you start us from the beginning? You start, your first chapter of the book is actually goes back to a comment that Lula made several years ago when Brazil actually got the Olympics that are happening right now and not necessarily turning out so well. And he actually said, God is a Brazilian. Can you bring us back to that time of that sort of headiness and sense of success in Brazil and maybe why it wasn't what people thought it was cracked up to be?
Yeah, you know, I arrived in Brazil in 2010, so I really got there at the peak of this almost euphoria about the country and its economic prospects. And this euphoria was something that you saw in headlines in international press, but it was also something that I felt being there and just talking with people, this optimism about the country was palpable. And this was a really new thing in Brazil. You know, it's a country that has been through many cycles of boom and bust. And it's a country where even when there were cycles, you know, in the boom part of the cycle, the poor rarely benefited.
Right.
And, you know, as you pointed out, under Lula, you know, social justice was one of his main goals, and the gains were distributed to the poor like they never had been before. More than 30 million people were lifted from extreme poverty. And so when Brazil won the right to hold first the World Cup and then the Olympics, it really felt like confirmation that the country had made it and that any day now it was going to join the club of developed nations.
So what was the hiccup to that? And then lead us to the sort of the premise of your book is you're actually literally profiling these different Brazilian billionaires and sort of mapping out what that represents in terms of Brazilian politics, in terms of Brazilian prosperity gospel and everything else. But what was the hiccup of why the Workers' Party and under Lula's leadership and Dilma's leadership couldn't quite square that circle?
A few things went wrong. One is luck. Part of this crazy boom that we saw under Lula is because commodity prices were soaring because of the Chinese economy. Commodity prices started to come down, and that hurt Brazil because it's a major commodities exporter. But that's only part of the story.
Can I ask really quick, Alex, what commodities are Brazil moving to China in the global market?
Well, oil is Brazil's biggest commodity. It now pumps more oil than Norway. It's also a major producer of iron ore, which is the raw ingredient in steel, and beef and soybeans. And so, you know, China, with its construction drive, needed a lot of iron ore for its steel factories. And, you know, its population was getting richer, eating more meat. So hence the beef, and has always been a major consumer of soybeans.
Okay.
But, you know, this was only part of the story. Other countries that are heavily dependent on commodities have not suffered as much. There's a strange contradiction inside the philosophy of development of the Workers' Party, which is Lula's and Dilma's party. On the one hand, they, you know, considered themselves left-wing and claimed to pursue social justice, but they also had this sort of economic nationalism and this idea that the way to pursue development was for the government to kind of foster national industries and to do that by funneling subsidies to major companies. The problem is that they didn't do it in a very smart way, or, you know, they didn't pick like, okay, we're going to develop our solar sector and, you know, funnel some subsidies there. They started handing out subsidies basically to anyone, any major company that asked. And so hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate tax breaks were handed out, especially in the last 6 years. Hundreds of billions of dollars in low-interest government loans. Something that a lot of people find surprising is that Brazil has a state development bank that doles out these loans, and in recent years, it lent out more just in Brazil than the World Bank lent out in the entire world. All of these subsidies saddled the country with a massive debt. And Brazil is a country with very high interest rates. So by last year, the government was spending just on interest payments the equivalent of 12 years of Bolsa Família, which is its flagship welfare program for very poor families.
So, and this is actually an important question then, because I think that one of the things that always struck me, and I've talked in the past with Anthony Pereira from I believe he's at King's College, the Brazil Institute there in the UK, and one of the things that he kind of pointed out, and this actually will lead us to the conversation about media coverage in Brazil, but when Lula first came to power, and I believe it was 2002. And then, you know, through several years of his presidency, and as you say, the commodity prices were booming. Lula's a very charismatic figure, so Dilma didn't have the same type of sort of adulation and sort of easier media treatment globally. But the interesting thing was that Lula was rebranded as, went from, you know, this sort of so-called radical left to the center left. I think he was actually never necessarily in the radical left. I think he's always just been a sort of canny, sophisticated labor union operative who's understood sort of how to, well, ironically, actually how to make deals. I know people can't really use that phrase anymore without thinking about our politics. But, you know, he was very shrewd about finding alliances, making deals, and redefining his interest. And when he rebranded himself in this more center-left way, it was presented in global press and United States press as like, well, you know, he's moved to the center, whatever that sort of means generically. It seems like in a Brazilian context, what that actually means is making peace with enormous levels of corruption in the corporate sector, in the parliament, in everywhere, in governance generally, and basically saying, look, if we can accommodate that to some degree and still deliver on social welfare, then we can actually win and we can actually govern. Whereas maybe in the 80s, the Workers' Party had a perspective of social justice and dealing with corruption is the same process. He decoupled that to an extent. And now, you know, you're in a situation with Dilma and impeachment and everything else where it's not that there aren't legitimate questions around Workers' Party, but they're getting impeached and removed from office by people who have, you know, members of parliament and their parties who are literally like under indictment for murders, you know, and then a press that has been used quite bluntly as just a political instrument of the opposition and not, you know, too coincidentally to reinforce a lot of problematic racial attitudes and everything else in Brazil. So, you know, maybe you comment on that and then lead us to start talking about one of the Brazilianaires you chronicle, which is Roberto Marinho, which I'm not sure I'm pronouncing correctly, but he was an important important media mogul. Maybe you could speak to that and then get to him and the sort of reality of Brazilian private media.
Yeah, well, you raised some great points, and there are a few issues here. You know, one is that, yes, Lula was and is a pragmatist, and there's obviously great value in that. You know, politics is the art of the possible. And, you know, there are a lot of people on the left, whether or not they support the Workers' Party, who say the only way that he could get this agenda through to help the poor was by buying votes in Congress. Mm-hmm. That, you know, making deals, and I can use this term without thinking of Trump because I have just moved to the U.S.
Lucky
but,
you.
Making deals with the corrupt old elite in the mind of many people in Brazil was the Faustian bargain that allowed progress to happen for the lower classes. Now, it's hard to say. Did he have another option? You know, that's an impossible counterfactual to test. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, one thing about his presidency is that he benefited from this fortuitous confluence of high commodity prices and so on that allowed him to avoid any kind of real confrontation with the elites in Brazil and with, you know, the richest 1%. So the poor could get richer, and the rich didn't have to give anything up. Mm-hmm. And I think that this was one of the major failings of the Workers' Party years, is that they abandoned some of their most important planks, one of which being a tax on large fortunes. They didn't even try in any way to make Brazil's tax system more progressive, and it's one of the most regressive in the world. Dividends, for example, are completely untaxed. The other thing that they completely abandoned was an attempt to ban campaign finance by companies. And, you know, the fact that they have this plank is a recognition of the influence that you suffer when your party is financed by special interests and by these billionaire families in Brazil that have always been at the center of power. And I think that at a certain point, you know, the Workers' Party, people in government, the incentives changed. And, you know, decisions weren't always made with, you know, the population at large in mind, but rather looking to, you know, are there projects that we can skim off the top of and finance our party so that we can keep winning elections. So I think that pragmatism is justifiable, and it's easy to be morally superior about the reality of corruption in a country like Brazil. But I think that the Workers' Party lost track of its idealism, and the pragmatism that was supposed to serve its initial ideals ended up kind of taking over the life of the party.
Right.
To bring things up to what's happening now with the impeachment and the media, you know, I think that the Workers' Party has pushed a narrative according to which it's the victim of a coup by elites. You know, I think this ignores the pragmatic deal-making that it's done and the fact that, you know, it kind of became an elite inside Brazil. I think that the situation with the media, a lot of times when it comes out in the international press, it's really hard to capture all the nuances. The media in Brazil definitely supported Dilma's impeachment as a general editorial line, but I think that you know, they couldn't have created this out of thin air, and that the impeachment is most of all the result of the Workers' Party's errors, be it economic errors or in terms of corruption.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm my sort of skepticism about that, and I want to get to these, you know, use it as actually get to some of these Brazilianaires in a moment. But I guess what I wonder is that if you're in a situation where, of course, the Workers' Party has made many errors and there's many valid criticisms and they've become, in some sense, part of the problem. At the same time, if they're the only sort of sector of this elite that is delivering any type of tangible goods and doing anything on these sort of inequality markers, I guess in some ways I read it in a really exaggerated way, but it almost reminded me of the way like Republicans respond to Obama here. Like in reality, Obama's an incredibly centrist guy, you know, very much to the, and has offered them, in fact, in 2010, 2011, offered them, you know, very right-wing proposals on slashing Social Security, Medicare, you know, Medicare spending, which would be a disaster in my view. But because it wasn't 100%, they refused it. And they've, you know, hated him sort of every step of the way because they have their own kind of fantasy version of Obama. And it seems like maybe there's some element of that in Brazil where it's like, you know, the Workers' Party made all of these concessions, did not go after the structural issues in terms of breaking up these monopolies that you write about. And then at the same time, the opposition and the sort of right-leaning press took an opportunity to try to destroy them regardless, even, and you know, what is the conclusion of that? If, you know, the structural issues are never touched and now we're just going to slash the spending that Workers' Party put in place, you know, I think that that has been, to some sense, my sort of read on it.
Right. You know, first of all, you know, I think that the first 10 years of the Workers' Party, you know, with Lula's two terms and the beginning of Dilma, you know, those gains are amazing and shouldn't be understated. But they built on gains from the 90s under another party that is seen as center-right, but would probably be about on the spectrum of the Democrats.
You're talking about the Cardozo, Hernando Cardozo years.
Exactly, exactly. You know, this is when Bolsa Família, the welfare program, was a vastly expanded version of various social programs that started during the 90s. And, you know, part of the reason that Lula was able to do that is this confluence of, you know, good luck from various places.
Right.
So, you know, I think your analogy to the American Congress and this obstructionist approach is apt. And, you know, Dilma is not very good at politics. She had never run for elected office before. People who have dealt with her say she's not very good at listening, taking criticism, you know, reaching across the aisle, as distasteful as that may be. You know, if someone else had been president, if Lula had still been president, even with this crisis, economic crisis and corruption, maybe the government would not have fallen.
Right. Okay, so give us some examples of some, if you had to name off the, just sort of off the top of your head, of the two or three sort of core Brazilian-era examples that kind of track this story you're telling, who would they be, and tell us about them?
There is a family called the Camargo family, and they own one of Brazil's largest construction companies. It's a company that is involved in building some projects for the Olympics and was involved in building some other projects for the World Cup. But this family has been at the center of power in Brazil since midway through the 20th century. It really, the company really became big during the military dictatorship that ruled from 1964 to 1985. And in 1969, the military created this off-the-books anti-subversion unit in São Paulo. And Dilma Rousseff, many years before she would become president, was a guerrilla, a member of an urban guerrilla group resisting the dictatorship. And she was arrested and taken to this anti-subversion unit and tortured.
Right.
And this anti-subversion unit was, because it was off the books, financed by São Paulo businessmen. And one of them was the owner of Camargo Correia, this construction company. Four decades later, that same company became one of the main campaign donors to Dilma's run for president.
I guess it's an interesting way of saying sorry. Might be.
Yeah, well, and
here's a campaign contribution.
I admire her her ability to, you know, get over that.
There's some reach across the aisle right there. You tortured me. I'll take some campaign contributions. That's something.
Yeah, no, that is something. But you know, this fact really shows the constancy of these major families at the center of power in Brazil, and shows how the relationship between billionaires and the state really doesn't depend on one party or another. You know, this relationship has basically always been the same. Even when there was a wave of privatization in the 90s, you know, in Russia, a whole new class of oligarchs was created, but because of privatizations. But in Brazil, there already were oligarchs, so they're the ones who bought up cheap state assets. So, you know, I think this really indicates how left and right are kind of too limited a lens for understanding how money and power work in Brazil.
Absolutely. Could you talk about and this is another name that you'll help me with, Edgar Machado, the preacher of the prosperity gospel in Brazil. This is a guy who is... also, who basically, though, is administering to the very poor and sort of preaching this prosperity gospel, but also, obviously, on your Brazilianaire list. What does that represent?
Edir Macedo. So, yeah, he's an evangelical
pastor.
That
was not even close. Okay.
Yeah, the pronunciation is really counterintuitive.
Yeah.
In Portuguese. Macedo grew up poor. He's one of your few rags-to-riches stories, actually, among Brazilian billionaires. But he didn't make his money in a very nice way. He became an evangelical pastor and built up a massive following. And he wanted to expand his influence by first buying radio stations and finally a TV station. And to finance the purchase of a major Brazilian TV station, he siphoned off his followers' donations in the form of interest-free loans from his church. And this TV network is now the second largest network in Brazil. And on the one hand, this really shows how natural is corruption in Brazil, and how natural it is to have massive fortunes that have been built on the basis of crimes. But the thing that surprised me, maybe as I researched him and as I started attending services at his church, is that, you know, yes, he is, and I need to use the word allegedly, a thief. But he also means something to a lot of people. He has 2 million followers in Brazil, and they're mostly working class. A lot of them are very poor, suffer from addictions, you know, have prostituted themselves, so on.
Right.
And what I discovered is that, you know, the poor in Brazil have always been fleeced, and they kind of know it. And they found in this guy, you know, someone who, a situation where at least they got something in return, a feeling of community, a message that they could somehow overcome their situation.
It's a real opium of the masses case study you're spelling out here. It's like a little intense almost.
I mean,
it's really kind of heartbreaking.
It's sad that that's the best that, that a lot of Brazilians feel that they can hope for.
Absolutely. I mean, tied to that, though, is there also, you know, and that's another place where there's an interesting parallel between, I think, the United States, actually, and maybe potentially in India and China as they rise, but the sort of culture of being working class or poor and sort of admiring extreme wealth, even though obviously that extreme wealth is in many cases connected with, you know, quite literally, you know, something that's fleecing you on some level, and that's sort of known. I mean, is there a culture of admiring that and a culture that's also sort of fetishizes like that kind of that same sort of story of upward mobility, and you know, you too could be a preacher who gets interest-free loans to create your own TV network type of thing?
There's definitely a connection to the United States here, and I think Brazil has a kind of schizophrenic relationship with wealth. You have, I'd say traditionally, people see wealth in Brazil as something inherently dirty because so many fortunes were made through corruption or government ties. But especially in recent years, people have come to really look up to entrepreneurs. And also actually as a function of this culture of corruption, because people look at the government and they look at these corrupt politicians who seem only interested in themselves, and they think, well, businessmen are the only ones who do anything right in this country.
Wow. And so the same myth as America right there.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Although it's something much newer in Brazil. And there was the billionaire who fascinated me the most of all of them was a guy named Ike Batista. Mm-hmm. He was Brazil's richest man in 2012, worth $30 billion, the world's eighth richest man. But and he loved to show off his wealth. He loved to show off his jets and his yachts, invite reporters to this sprawling mansion. He had a $35,000 hairpiece. And this was something really new in Brazil.
This conversation is too many parallels in this conversation to what's going on here. Except except he actually had the money, apparently.
Right. Well, and people made the parallel openly. People said he was like Brazil's Donald Trump. And
if I was him, I'd be offended. He has the actual paper.
What's that?
I said, if I was him, I'd be offended. He has the actual paper, it sounds like. Yeah.
Well, he ended up losing everything. But,
oh, I see.
Much like Donald Trump,
much like him.
He framed himself as a self-made man. You know, he liked to say he grew up middle class and he did it all himself. The fact was, though, that he was the son of a government minister who went on to lead one of the major mining companies, the biggest mining company in Brazil, and helped his son at various points in his career.
So Brazil literally is America. It's just it's the same country.
Well, you know, there's a reason that the subtitle of my book refers to Brazil as an American country.
Right. So, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say that, the rise of this guy, Ike Batista, it was like he embodied this kind of schizophrenia in Brazil. And people kind of deposited their hopes in him and, saw him as proof that they could also make themselves rich. You know, he wrote a best-selling self-help book and so on. But it was a lie, and social mobility really, doesn't exist anywhere near the level that he tried to convey, much like in the United States, although much more extreme.
How did he lose it?
It was basically a stock market bubble. Mm-hmm. He created a series of startups in commodities. He had an oil company that he said was going to develop these offshore oil deposits. He had a mining company that he said was going to exploit these rich iron ore deposits. He was going to build this, what he called his super port, that would be this industrial complex and would become a highway to China for Brazilian goods. But, he pitched basically PowerPoint presentations. He pitched companies that had no revenues.
Yep.
And investors were so excited about Brazil, and he was such a charismatic salesman, like something from the id of capitalism almost, this like parody of billionaire playboy who had married a playboy cover girl and carnival queen and so on.
Nice.
People bought into it, and when it turned out that he didn't have all that he said he had, and the wells offshore Brazil started coming up dry, his companies tanked in the stock market. He couldn't pay back his debts, and he lost everything, $30 billion in about a year and a half.
Wow. Well, he should move here and advise the Republicans on economic policy. I think that's the next move for him. Set up a speaking tour with Trump and Marco Rubio. He'd fit right in.
I think they would get along.
Oh, absolutely. It's all in the, clearly it's in the same continuum. I have to ask you the question now that's always a little bit unfair, so you could take it as whichever way you want, which is the, you know, we're still in the impeachment process. There's incredible divisions in Brazil. I don't think the Workers' Party is going away. I don't think, obviously, the deeper issues that you identify in this book are far transcend these political dramas, although they're implicated in them. The Olympics is happening. I mean, what happens next? What do you foresee coming out of this experience in this book for Brazil in its near future, at least?
Well, that is indeed a really hard question, and Brazil experts, are all kind of flummoxed. I think that in the short term, we're going to see more political chaos. The country is incredibly polarized. People don't consider the interim president soon to probably be made full president when the impeachment goes through after the Olympics. They don't see him as legitimate.
Right.
Less than half the country thinks that the impeachment process is following the Constitution. I think the near term isn't pretty. In the medium to long term, I try to be optimistic, and it's not always easy, but the corruption investigations that started in 2014, I really do think that there's something really new in Brazil. Not just because they're targeting politicians, and it's fair to see that so far mostly Workers' Party politicians have been targeted, partly because of their central role in the multi-billion-dollar corruption scheme at Petrobras. But billionaires are facing real penalties for the first time in Brazil. I mean, this doesn't even really happen in the United States.
No.
And we have Marcelo Odebrecht, who is the heir to one of these construction families that has been around for so long. He's in jail, and he's facing 20 years in prison. That's unheard of. And, you know, if you start to change the incentives gradually and painfully for the political class and the business class in Brazil, this could make the country a better place, but it's going to take a while.
I actually thought you were going to use this as an opportunity to pitch a new iron ore investment project. Like, don't count Brazil out. It's coming back. Look, Alex Quadros, I really appreciate your time. The book is fascinating. It's Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. Alex, really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, we are going to go to the fun half of the program where we do things like take your calls, where we do things like play sound of Glenn Beck. We do things like play sound of Alex Jones. We do things like ask Matt questions about just what the hell is going on.
We take calls sometimes by good prank phone callers.
Sometimes by good prank callers.
Sometimes by people with maybe a bit low energy.
Sometimes by people who maybe should be eating their Wheaties.
Yep, but it's fun.
Taking their super male vitality.
Whatever happens, we make fun of it.
Yeah, I mean, look, whatever scenario you give me, I mock, okay? It's true. And that number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. 3920. Of course, got some stories to get to. The IMs are open. 646-257-3920. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Become one of our collective bosses. It's a $10 a month membership, and it makes this all possible. We obviously get advertising and all the rest, but fundamentally we rely on you, which is kind of amazing. So thank you, everybody who already are members, and we look forward to more of you joining. Write us a review on iTunes. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys on iTunes, Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. Write that a review. Go to Majority Report Kickback, and I guess now you can use our Amazon link again. as well as our jet lag. Though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate the hustle. What can I say? What else can you do for us? JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, and Chocolate, 646-257-3920. If you call, don't be a cuck. See you in the fun half.